Welcome to this month's Aikens Book Talks podcast. I'm very pleased to be speaking today to Herman Salton. Herman is actually on the line with us from the Asian University for Women in Chittagong, Bangladesh, which also means it's later in the evening for you. Herman, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Well, we're chatting about your book, Dangerous Diplomacy, Bureaucracy, Power, Politics, and the Role of the UN Secretariat in Rwanda. And I very much, as you know, you and I have chatted in advance of this, I very much enjoyed reading it in an odd kind of way, because in many ways it's also a depressing thing to read, to think about, find out more about some of the pathologies inside the UN at that time. We will come to the substantive core of your book, but first of all, I wanted to ask you about the access that you had to the archives of the late Sir Marek Golding, who served as Under Secretary General for Peacekeeping in 92 to 93, and then USG Political Affairs in 93 to 97, the periods obviously immediately before, during, and after the genocide. Can you tell us about the archive? How were you given the access? How did you organize your research? And what sorts of challenges did you face in working with his diaries and papers?
Sure. So those are very good questions. In terms of my own access to the archive, it was actually largely accidental, nothing to do with my detective skills. I was actually in Oxford doing my master's degree at that time, and Marek Golding was basically, he had just passed away, and I was doing research, and I was contacted by a former professor of mine who asked me to be in touch with the family, and I contacted the family asking for access to the archive. And so I was given very kindly access to the archive in London very shortly after he passed away. And so I went down to London and I was doing my research there. But I very quickly found out that nobody had looked at the archive and that there was a lot of personal information about the archive itself. And so I contacted the family and I asked basically them to look into the archive first. They did, and they were fairly horrified by the level of private information that it contained. Mm-hmm. This is not only a professional archive, it's also a personal archive. And so the family decided to allow me to work on it, but also to embargo it for a number of years because of the level of confidentiality information. And as a result of that, the archive is being given to the Oxford Bodleian Library, but it's going to be embargoed for a number of years just because of the sensitive nature of some of the personal information on his life.
Okay.
So this is basically how I gain access to it. In terms of my own research, what I've done is that this is a very extensive archive, mixing basically the personal with the professional. Yeah. Golding was a workaholic. He was keeping about 3 diaries a day, including actually meeting diaries, personal diaries, and traveling diaries. So we are talking about a very large amount of information. And that was across his 40-year career. So it's not clear to me how he could do that, but he did.
Yeah.
And very tidily, also very, very well organized. In terms of my own organization, I've decided to structure the book in 2 parts, as you might have seen the structures and the processes, and maybe we can come back later in the course of this podcast on the reasons for that division.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most interesting thing here are the challenges that the archive posed, which were and remain very significant. I talk in my introduction about internal bias and external bias. Internal bias because we are dealing with diaries that necessarily are subjective, and so this is a perspective of one person, and so we have to be very careful with that perspective. But there's also an external bias to some extent, because I did work for some time at the UN in exactly Golding's office, and so I might also have my own ways of looking at things, and I go into my introduction quite extensively into the dangers of that. In terms of my own approach, has been one of balancing the Golding archive with the other sources that are available on Rwanda, which are actually quite extensive. I've also looked at the French archives, the Belgian archives, and other archives specifically on Rwanda, and really trying to balance a huge amount of primary materials as best as I could. But there is a considerable danger of bias of which I'm aware, and we can if you have any other question about that, mm-hmm. I would be very happy to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those methodological questions are actually, sure. Well, obviously very interesting for a lot of ACON's members who are themselves research scholars. If we have time, we'll come back to those at the end of the podcast. But in your introduction to the book, you note the strengths but also the limitations for your work of constructivist and principal-agent theories of international relations as frameworks for understanding the politics of international organizations. Now, your study provides a very, very richly detailed look into the functioning or often the dysfunction of the UN Secretariat at that time. Who are or who were the key agents in the drama that you describe, and what kind of roles either did they play or were they seeking to play?
Yeah, there were several agents. I just would like to point out that I restricted my observation largely to New York and to the actors that were in the Secretariat, because that's the perspective I adopted, and this is itself a limitation not only of my research but also of my book, not only just dealing with one case study, but also specifically dealing with the Secretariat, which doesn't mean, by the way, that I blame the Secretariat in any way for the genocide. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't mean that I think the Secretariat is most responsible than other actors, but looking at the Secretariat was, I think, very interesting for me and important because it is one of the least researched parts of the United Nations organization. Mm-hmm. The assumption being a realist assumption that the UN effectively is just an expression of states' interests, and so we have a very strong realist bias there. Basically, the assumption that also the Secretary General is not really powerful or important, and so why would we ever look at what he controls in New York, given that he doesn't have power himself? So how can his departments be powerful or influential, for that matter? And I found that assumption quite problematic as a result not only of the archive. I also would like to point out that I first worked at the UN very briefly at the Department of Political Affairs and the Secretary General's office before I had access to the Golding Archive. And to me, that was very interesting because I was looking at a machine that had different parts. I was coming from an academic background, but I took a leave of absence. And because I was coming from an academic IR background, I also came with assumptions about the UN, UN Secretariat being basically rather monolithical and therefore being one of the players, not the most important player, but one of the players, and being firmly under the control of the Secretary General. And I discovered very quickly that was not the case. The Secretariat that I saw in New York was very, very, very divided internally. There were different departments that were not necessarily working together. In fact, they were not working together. Some of these departments were more powerful than others, or at least more influential. And some of these departments were clearly, if not outside the control of the Secretary General, certainly not within the giving of the Secretary General or the influence of the Secretary General. And so to me, that was a very quick realization, and it came before I had access to any archive. And I was quite actually struck by the fragmentation of the Secretariat and also by how different parts of the Secretariat were influenced by different players. And I'm coming now to your question about what kind of players there were in the 1990s, basically in the early 1990s in Rwanda. In Rwanda, we had a variety of players, but I want to, my assumption when I came, and this is a limitation, when I came to the UN in 2008 was that there were two UNs, because I did my readings before going to the UN and I'd studied the literature, and so apparently there were two UNs, and one was the member states. The assumption, and perhaps even prejudice, if you want, my own prejudice was that these were the bad guys, and therefore the people that, or the bureaucrats that basically do their national interests without any regard for human rights and the larger interest of humanity on the one side, and then on the other side you have the good guys with the Secretariat officials, Secretary General, who were supposed to basically save the world. And, you know, I recognize, I mean, this is a character, but this is very much the approach that I had. I also have to say that as an international lawyer by training, I've been trained to believe that international law is very important and that, you know, considerations of power don't really matter or at least shouldn't matter the most. When I arrived at the UN, I quickly realized that was not the case. In the case of the Secretariat, you had a division, especially between two departments that was quite remarkable, between specifically the Department of Political Affairs, or DPA, and the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, or DPKO. And when I was at the UN, that realization came in the context of UN reform, especially in terms of empowering the political or preventive diplomacy mechanisms of the UN, which we were working at the DPA. In the case of Rwanda, what I discovered through the Golding archive, and Golding, by the way, worked many, many years earlier, but he noticed very similar things, and I was struck by the fact that I was going through the archive that he had seen exactly the same things in the early 90s. And by the same things, I mean this very strong separation, this very strong rivalry between these two departments that I mentioned, and also attempts by different states to control these two departments. He wrote it in the diaries, which have not been published yet. Mm. This is one of the aims, actually one of the reasons why the family gave them to me, because in the end they will be published, at least some parts that are not private. But he noticed that straight away, and that's also what I'd seen in the United Nations when I was there. What is interesting is that the timing here is very important. These two departments, DPA and DPKO, were established in 1992. We are talking immediately after the end of the Cold War, at a time when Boutros Ghali had just become Secretary General, and he was bent on reforming the United Nations Secretariat, and this was his grand design, a design that, by the way, still stands in New York to this day. What is interesting is that the two departments really became functional in 1993, and it is exactly in the middle of 1993 that the Rwanda operation was established. Mm. And in fact, the Rwanda operation is one of the first to have been established under this division of new divisional roles between these two departments. And I blame that division of roles for a lot that went on in the Secretariat and also in Rwanda as far as the Secretariat was concerned. Mm. Basically, the idea, which is still, by the way, officially the situation today, is that the Department of Political Affairs was really apparently doing political work, and so dealing with peace building, largely, and preventive diplomacy, whereas the Peacekeeping Operations Department basically intervened once the peace agreement had been reached, then the DPKO would take over. And there is this artificial division of roles, which in my view cannot work, because the borders between peacekeeping and peace building cannot be separated so neatly, certainly not in terms of creating two distinct departments, one dealing with one and one dealing with the other. Mm. And so the interesting thing is that in Rwanda, the most important players were these two departments. The first factor that came into play was therefore a very strong bureaucratic competition between these two departments. Like all good bureaucracies, the Secretariat has a lot of bureaucratic competition, and these two departments, I think, are emblematic of that competition. Mm. But what I found out, both when I was there and also through the archive, is that, and what is interesting about the UN bureaucracy, is that these parts of the UN bureaucracy were very interested for a number of member states, in fact, for a number of actors. And these were the actors that tried to control some of these departments, specifically these two departments. Mm. And the reason why I find this very interesting is because the two main actors here that tried to exercise some influence over these two departments are actually what we call the two UNs. On the one hand, member states that have always been very fond of the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, which was, by the way, defined to me by a UN official as the blue-eyed boy of member states, although it's a very gendered expression.
Yeah.
But that gives you the idea of the importance that member states attach to the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. This is seen as the action department, largely staffed by member states' personnel, because, as you know, the UN, when it comes to military matters, is not very strong, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you had a different situation with the Department of Political Affairs, which was supposed to be Boutros Ghali's right-hand office or department, and therefore very close to the Secretary General. And in theory, doing basically what the Secretary General wanted him to do. And so what is interesting is that the agents behind these two departments were, on the one hand, member states, and more specifically the U.S. in the case of DPKO. And on the other hand, for DPA, was actually the Secretary General who was trying to assert his authority within the New York bureaucracy. So this is interesting because the behavior of these two departments in Rwanda were different from each other. They had different takes. They had different, to some extent, also intelligence. And I think we're going to talk about that, Intelligence information. So the agents of the drama, as you want to call it, on the one hand are member states, but largely the United States, really having a lot of influence over the DPKO. And on the other hand, the Secretary General, a very active Secretary General, who was trying to assert his independence through the DPA. And so this was the perfect clash. And the first mission, really, that this played out, the clash was actually Rwanda. And so not two bureaucratic entities, but these two bureaucratic entities were, to some extent, influenced by very different actors, in theory having very different interests, and also in theory, or supposedly to promote interests that are quite distinct from each other.
You mentioned, and in fact, we're well into the next question I wanted to ask you. But since we're on that, one question I had about that game, if you will, although I don't like using the word game when we're talking about the genocide in Rwanda. But you also wrote in your book about the confusion that existed about how to understand and apply the ideas of peacekeeping and peace building. And that fed into the, I guess, rivalry, if you will, between DPA and DPKO.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so bureaucracies want nothing better than having roles that are confusing and confused. And I think with DPA and DPKO, we have the pinnacle of that confusion, because the idea that you can separate the process of peacekeeping and that of peace building and having a very linear division between the two is quite problematic. In my view, is actually one of the reasons why these two departments have been coming into conflict with each other for a very long time. It is particularly problematic in the case of the DPA because, and you know, in my book, I go through quite a lot of discussions about the term political, which is in the DPA's name. Now, a department that is supposed to handle political affairs at the United Nations is, by definition, a very busy department because everything is political at the United Nations. And actually, that came, I thought it came as a, I mean, it came as a shock to me. As it happens, it didn't come as a shock to my former department because they were quite happy about that situation because, of course, the more sweeping your role is or sounds, then the more powers you can actually claim to have. And from a bureaucratic point of view, the more bureaucratic encroachment you can claim. So in the case of the Political Affairs Department, this is a department that is supposed to be handling not only peace building, but also preventive diplomacy. And this is very important. One of the main points of Boutros Ghali's reform in 1992 was to say that the DPA was to be responsible for all political functions of peacekeeping. So anything that had to do with political role in peacekeeping operations was supposed to be the responsibility of DPA, not of DPKO, which was regarded by Boutros Ghali as a technical department. And so when Boutros Ghali took over in 1992, the cornerstone of his reform was to say DPA is the political affairs department, is the one that does peace building, is the one that does preventive diplomacy, is by far the most important thing the UN does. DPKO has to be subordinate to DPA. It is a technical department. It only does operational matters and basically does whatever DPA tells it to do. And so the idea that in peacekeeping operations, you can separate what is technical and what is political, I think is a very problematic distinction, which I think had very damaging effects, not only in Rwanda, but in peacekeeping operations ever since. Mm. Because, of course, then the PKO very reasonably said, I'm sorry, but peacekeeping is political in itself. How can you separate the political side from the operational side? And, you know, is a, I don't know, like something along the lines of, in the case of Rwanda, for example, a ceasefire agreement, is that a political issue? Is that a technical operational issue? What about other things like the mission size? Is a mission size decisions, is it a political decision? Is it an operational decision? And what is interesting is that from a bureaucratic point of view, this was a heaven because both departments could claim confusion. And that meant that both departments claimed to be in charge of most of the issues that the other department also claimed to be in charge of. Mm-hmm. Again, this is not only, this is classic bureaucratic theory, so there's nothing new in this. What is new in this is that the big powers behind these two departments were even happier because, of course, they would be claiming more influence for their own departments, and therefore, for example, the Secretary General was behind the reform. The whole purpose of the reform was to strengthen DPA for two reasons. One, because, and I think he was absolutely correct in this, to say that prevention is much better than cure, and so presumably we want to prevent conflict rather than kicking in and do peacekeeping. Mm-hmm. But there was another, perhaps less noble reason why he wanted to do this, which had nothing to do with, the situation on the ground. But basically, he wanted to limit DPKO because DPKO meant member states. DPKO meant specifically the United States, and DPKO meant Kofi Annan.
Yeah.
And by this time, Boutros-Ghali had already fairly negative views on Kofi Annan and was actually quite afraid of losing his job, as he actually turned out to lose it. So it's a combination of bureaucratic reasons, but also reasons of influence from the two biggest players in international relations, in addition to personal rivalry, which also played a very significant role here.
Now, I know this is a selfish question for me to ask as a Canadian, but obviously you look at Boutros-Ghali and at Golding and at Annan. You also look fairly candidly at General Romeo Dallaire as one of the actors in this tragedy. Given everything that you've talked about with the rivalries between the different groups or the different ambitions of the different actors there, to what extent do you think Dallaire did everything that he could do in the circumstances that he had to operate in?
Yeah, so that's a very difficult question. Mm. And I was reminded of this question almost every day as I was writing this book and wondering what I would have done in those circumstances. That was a very depressing situation because I think when you are in a situation of crisis, like especially the Rwanda case, then it's very difficult to predict what we would do. And so we are all very good at, you know, judging other people's actions. Mm-hmm. But once, you know, if we were to be put in those situations, I think certainly as far as I'm concerned, probably the result would be disastrous. But nevertheless, I am an academic, and so, of course, I have my views on this. In terms of Dallaire, I think he did everything that he could during the genocide. To me, there is no doubt that he was very brave and that he behaved as better as he could under very difficult circumstances. So from the moment that the genocide began, I have the highest admiration. I mean, I have highest admiration in any case for Dallaire, but specifically during the tragedy that unfolded from the 6th of April, I think that actually he saved lives, and I don't think that there's anything more noble that a UN official can do. My problem in terms of assessment of Dallaire had more to do with the phase that precedes the genocide, which has been neglected by the literature, which is why I give it quite a lot of attention in my book, particularly the planning of the mission, because I think that a lot of the problems, obviously not the genocide itself, but a lot of the operational issues actually had their roots in the planning phase. Mm. Now, Dallaire found himself in a very difficult situation, being called to New York, being told basically this is you have a very small budget, this is going to be a very small mission, so either you accept this and you recommend a certain number of troops that cannot go beyond a certain number, or we are not going to approve your mission. And Dallaire, by the way, talks about this in his own memoirs, and he is apologetic, and he also wonders whether he should have accepted, because the projected level was initially 5,000. He accepted what basically DPKO demanded, which was 2,500, knowing very well that that was not enough for the mission to succeed, or at least to succeed without major threats. So to me, that's a problem because, again, as an academic, probably if I were a military person, might have been a different perspective, but to initiate a mission with the troop levels that are half of what you think is necessary, because there's no doubt that Dallaire thought that 5,000 was the projected level, I think that's problematic. Again, we have the benefit of hindsight, so perhaps in any other circumstance or peacekeeping operation, it would have been fine. In this case, it turned out to be a problem. But the troop numbers actually mattered because there have been studies conducted saying that given the number of troops that remained in Rwanda, there was a very high chance that the Security Council might have acted differently. One of the reasons why the Security Council pulled out or reduced the mission radically is because the mission was already very small. So to me, Dallaire is... if he's at fault, he's at fault of accepting troop numbers levels that are very different from what he thought were necessary. The other thing that I think might be problematic, but this is not Dallaire's fault, is the fact that he was in charge of the reconnaissance mission in August 1993. And so this is the person that went, talked to the political actors, parties, leaders in 1993 ahead of the mission. But Dallaire was not a diplomat, he was not a politician, and so his own understanding of the situation was limited. Again, I don't think this was in any way Dallaire's fault, because the person in charge, who was supposed to be in charge of that reconnaissance, was supposed to be a DPA, a political affairs officer who could not go at the last minute. But it tells you something about the confusion in which the mission was planned, to have a military person go and do a reconnaissance of what was most crucially a political process or negotiation. I think it's quite problematic, and I think Dallaire paid very personally for mistakes, in this case, mistake that was not in any way his own.
Yeah. When you, again, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but when you examine the UN's intelligence gathering efforts in 1994, you argue there that the problem was fragmentation rather than ignorance. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. This has been, by the way, is nothing revolutionary. This was found out, for example, in the UN report, the Lessons Learned report. But I think my perspective is slightly different. The UN report basically said, oh, you know, DPKO and DPA and different parts of the UN didn't work in sync. That is actually a serious understatement. As far as I'm concerned, from the evidence that I've seen, they were actively trying not to share information with each other. And one of the reasons I say that is you would be, of course, I think everybody is aware with the famous genocide fax sent by Dallaire in January 1994, sent to DPKO directly warning of not genocide, by the way, but basically episodes of ethnic cleansing, a situation that might get out of control. Not genocide, but certainly a very, very serious situation that was going to explode in Dallaire's views. So that was January 1994. That was only 4 months before the genocide, and everybody has concentrated on this specific piece of evidence because, of course, it's very important. I don't think, by the way, that the assessment has been done properly. This is a cable that was sent directly from Dallaire to the DPKO. The Secretary General was not copied, of course. This is an operational fax, and so it was sent directly to DPKO. But DPKO shared it with a number of players within the UN Secretariat. And it is true that among these kind of mailing lists, there was also the Secretary General's office. And so DPKO's position is, well, we shared it, and, you know, please don't blame us because we have done everything we could to share it. That is not, I don't think, accurate, because this was a number of cables that were sent regularly to the Secretary General's office, including for each single mission, not only to the Secretary General's office, but we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of cables sent and copied to a number of different actors. So if you think that one document is particularly important and you want to highlight that document, you don't share it together with other hundreds of different cables. You actually make a call and you raise the issue directly with the Secretary General. So this is actually, when Boutros Ghali says, I've never seen that cable, it was not brought to my level of attention, I think he has a point, except that I'm now going to undermine his own position, because what I discovered is that in December 1993, so 1 month before that cable sent to DPKO, the Secretary General himself had received confidential information that the President Habyarimana in Rwanda or his party was preparing to exterminate, or at least to have a mass extermination of Tutsis. Mm-hmm. And this was a month before DPKO was informed by the Lair. This was a very similar piece of information. We don't know where Boutros Ghali got it from, but we know that he immediately contacted DPA and, in fact, dispatched the DPA boss to Kigali with an order to go and tell President Habyarimana that the UN was aware of his plans and that the UN would not accept this, and that the UN would basically consider Habyarimana personally responsible for anything that happened, especially to the Tutsi. So, you know, on the one hand, it is true that DPKO had not, I don't think, done much in terms of raising the alarms for a cable that was very, very significant. On the other hand, Boutros Ghali also didn't do much. Well, he did contact the DPA. DPA was fully involved, but DPA also did not share that piece of information with DPKO. And so the reason why I talk about fragmentation is that we had two very similar messages coming through the pipeline of the UN, in fact, two different pipelines, one going to basically the Secretary General and DPA, the other going to the DPKO, and they were not shared with each other. So to me, that's a big problem, because either it is a situation of gross incompetence, but I don't think so. I think it's part of a situation where the two departments were used not to share information, because information, as you know, is power. And this is, by the way, one of the reasons why the great powers want to control the UN bureaucracy, because if you control the information, is power. So if you control the UN bureaucracy, you also control the information that comes out of the UN bureaucracy. And if you control that information, you are basically in charge of directing a certain decision in a certain way or in another. So to me, this is not an innocent or even bureaucratic problem. To me, this is a problem of influence on the departments.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have, I'm not going to go too far into the, you have a very interesting discussion in a chapter on morality in the book, and especially on Boutros Ghali's moral authority in the case of Rwanda. And I want to encourage readers to buy the book, to go and find out more about that. But I would very much like to end by asking you how you see the UN now, how you see the UN under the new Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, addressing the different concepts, the kind of organizational challenges or needs of peacekeeping and peace building, given everything that you've talked about and written about in your book. Is there some light at the end of the tunnel in dealing with these issues?
Well, I think it's very interesting that Secretary General Guterres has asked what is it that kept him awake at night. Actually, didn't say it was Trump, but said that it was the UN bureaucracy. So to me, that's very significant. I have no reasons to believe that Secretary General Guterres will try not to reform the UN Secretariat. I think he has actually a very interesting take. I think he's generally committed to reform. But I also think it is quite significant that the first visit that he paid was to Washington, where he was praised by President Trump. Nikki Haley, the UN permanent representative to the UN, was very complimentary of Guterres' reform. And so to me, the big question, there are actually two big questions. The first one is, who is going to benefit from this reform of the UN Secretariat? It is true that the U.S. pays a disproportionate amount of money to the U.N., for especially for peacekeeping. So it is, some people say it is understandable that they would have a say over reform efforts and perhaps even over some departments at the United Nations. I think that's very dangerous. And the reason why I've written the book is actually to highlight the fact that if you want, or if we want, as I assume that we want, a successful United Nations Secretariat, then the independence of the International Civil Service is absolutely critical, because the civil servants of the UN Secretariat are not supposed to be there to please Washington or Moscow or Beijing. They are supposed to actually watch over those guys. Yeah. And I know this sounds very idealistic, and you know, I accept that. But there is a reason why we have an international civil service. I think Guterres is a very good example of that independence in the past, and I hope he will continue to remain that. I think he's also very skillful in terms of perhaps pleasing the Trump administration on certain things. But the important question now is who is going to benefit from this reform? And I think that's something I would want to watch very closely. What kind of departments? So the suggestions that he, Guterres, made was for a strengthening of the political department, which is great. I mean, I work there, and I'm a very, very strong fan of UN preventive diplomacy. I think it should absolutely be strengthened. But I also think that that's the department that Washington wants to be strengthened, and not necessarily because of preventive diplomacy, but for other reasons. My problem with Guterres' reform is twofold. The first one is that he continues to use the term political, and so the distinction between political aspects of peacekeeping and peacebuilding and the technical aspects of peacekeeping, he continues to use the vocabulary. I think that's a recipe for disaster when it comes to especially the bureaucracy. And the other problem that I have is, I think, the issue that we started with, that conceptual separation and confusion between peacekeeping and peacebuilding. These are two concepts that are very fluid, and to have two different parts of the UN Secretariat dealing with these two different concepts, I find it very problematic. These, of course, raises the issue of what I would do if I were to tackle this problem. By the way, Golding had recommended in 1996, there was a grand design by Boutros Ghali and Golding to merge DPA and DPKO, precisely on the assumption that you could not separate the political and the operational or technical aspects of peacekeeping. The U.S. was extremely opposed, and in fact, all member states were opposed to this proposal, which was then abandoned. And if you notice, that the merging of the two departments has not been proposed by Guterres either.
Yeah.
And some people say that's because member states want to continue to maintain a form of control over the operational or the peacekeeping department. So to me, Guterres is up to a very formidable challenge. I think he has the experience to try to make a difference. But I think what happened in the past, especially during the 90s, and this very enthusiastic reaction by Washington and this very concerned reaction by other capitals, to me suggests what I think I also suggested in my book, which is that the UN bureaucracy is actually, on the one hand, it is used by member states and by the Secretary General, but it also uses the member states and the Secretary General for their own bureaucratic purposes. So this is not an innocent, this is not a situation of, you know, having an innocent party such as the bureaucracy being thrown here and there by big players. It's also a question of the bureaucracy itself basically adapting to who is the big power of the day and being actually very skillful at doing what that power wants it to do. And I think that is very dangerous.
Yeah. I can hear Bangladeshi traffic in the background there.
Yes, it's never far away.
Yeah. Herman, it really is a, I mean, I'm not saying this as a sales pitch. It's a fascinating book. And as you mentioned at the start of our discussion, you're not placing blame on people, but you are looking very carefully at the roles and responsibilities, the rivalries, the the pathologies in the bureaucracy and the interests of the different people there inside the UN Secretariat. So I definitely recommend that people have a look at it. It's a fascinating book to read. And thank you very much for taking time on what is for you a later evening or a later night in Bangladesh on a Friday for taking that time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.